Thank you. Thank you. What's the date?
16.
16 March, 8015. Sand Hill Special Briefing Course. Well, didn't bring my notes. Because I got to get another gag, that one. Nobody laughs at it anymore. This has been a mad sprint. This is a mad sprint. Back in 1950, people used to yammer at me. Of course, I knew how to administer and administration in general. They used to yammer at me, why don't you do something about the organization? Yap, you know, ARC break. Why don't you just drop everything you're doing and go in there and push a desk? Very important. You push a desk. And all of this added up to a big bunch of nonsense. In the first place, I got caught absolutely flat-footed in 1950, completely flat-footed. Wrote a book. Published on March the 9th. Anniversary of it has just gone by. Dianetics, Modern Science, Mental Health. I was even contracting at the time to go on and do some stories and novels and so forth. And I had for a number of years paid for all research and so forth out of my own money or my products, the products of writing. And there I was, minding my own business. And the book hit. Nobody ever expected this book to be a bestseller. And it went instantly and immediately to the top of the bestseller list, and it just stayed there and stayed there and stayed there and stayed there. I had a lousy publisher. He was caught flat-footed, too. He was an ex-commie. He's still alive over in New York. He tries occasionally to put out a timid paw in my direction, and when I don't instantly answer up, he ARC breaks like crazy. Finally, HCOSecNY was able to get in touch with him the other day. And it's all good roads and good weather now. But it actually blew him off of his post. It blew him out of his own publishing firm. Because nobody expected it. And his publishing firm was rigged to publish books and make a little money. And all of a sudden it found itself with too much money to do with. And there were just these thousands and tens of thousands of dollars rolling in the front door of that place, and they had one of the biggest book publishers in the country, and yet they still couldn't turn out enough books. Everybody was short of books, short of books, short of books, short of books. And it was just too much confusion, whatever the political allegiances and other things of the people concerned and so forth. It was just too much. Nobody's braced for this at all. Next thing I knew, right after the book was published and so forth, a bunch of chaps came down to see me and told me they'd fixed up a foundation for me and all was going to be well and they would run all this. That was, in essence, what it was. That moment, I took my finger off my number and I said, all right, it's all right with me. And oddly enough, at those very first meetings, some actions were proposed by me, which we just now are getting the completed cycle of action on, and for lack of which, everything has been appetite over tin cup. But I had one vote amongst eight or nine, or I've forgotten how many it was, and it was just by dint of personality I tried to hold the thing together. You never heard so much squirreling and mess up and so forth in your life. And I didn't have any management control, nothing. As a matter of fact, at that time, you may find it hard to credit, perhaps, but I was totally anonymous as far as anything but the author of the book was concerned. I had a number of U.S. senators interested in this. As a matter of fact, I had the Senate dining room one day. I had lots of friends down there in those days. Still would have if I went down and stuck my nose in. every time I do, why, they all say, "Hey, Ron, where the hell have you been, you know? What's the matter, are you mad at me?" or something like that. I say, "Well, I've been busy." And I had the Senate dining room down there one noon, I remember, along about this period. And you could have heard a toothpick fall from one end of it to the other. I was simply telling people about a group of scientists had found, you see, your effort to leave it anonymous and that sort of thing is well born. Occasionally, why you don't want to use the word or something like this, or you're being timid. And yet I was telling them somebody had found the dynamic principle of existence. I was telling people what it was and so forth, and that place was jammed from one corner to the other with senators and so forth. Next thing you know, the table outside of the perimeter, the table I was sitting at with three or four old senators, and the table outside that went silent, and the table outside that went silent, the table outside that went silent, and the next thing you know, there wasn't anything happening in that dining room. The waiters were standing there, see? Darndest thing you ever wanted to see, you know? And I said, "Gee, I thought I got a bear by the tail here, you know." That was actually before anything much had occurred. They had never heard of this book or anything. But I said, "Well, I just write the stuff up, you know." And actually, that was my attitude until about July of 1950. Well, I just wrote it. And I wasn't making any commotion. I wasn't promoting my writing name. Actually, a writer seldom promotes his own writing name anyhow. Names, of course, to me are very, very indifferent things. After all, I am very well known under about six pen names, you see, so names don't mean much to me. As the guy that was important, but this one name, started to move up and hit me in the face, don't you see? I've worn it very pleasantly and so forth since. It isn't that L. Ron Hubbard is a pen name. It happens to be my own name. But this name was strictly exclamation points, you see, around the place. And I was trying not to wear that hat. And finally, the fellow who was serving a general manager at that time, I was having to do fantastic things. I was putting the place together with my bare hands. Everybody else was running around being important. I'm working stiff myself. I wouldn't quite know what it is to be a sedentary type desk flyer, you know. Just flying a desk as an executive, you see, sitting there at 0 mph, going madly down the carpet. You know? And I wouldn't quite know what that was. And I was all over the place, and I think I was delivering 8 hours of lecture a day, or something of that sort. I was teaching about three or four courses. I was buying all the furniture, putting everything together. I'd had to go out and find the building myself because I found out the reason they couldn't find a building is they went around and told everybody with a poor mouth, well, we're just a charity organization. We can't pay very much. I kept saying, "Gee, man, we're expanding. We got to get out of here, you know." "Oh, I've been trying everywhere." And so I said, "Parker, you come along with me." I said, "I'm certain that there are buildings in this city." And that was what he was telling people. "We're just a charity organization. We can't pay very much. We don't have very much money." Money, my God, the doors were falling in with money. And I just cut him off and just scolded him right in front of the building owner of the building we were standing in, you know. "What do you mean telling people lies like that? You've got to conquer that hard habit of yours, Parker, telling people lies like that." Turned around the fellow and said, "We got plenty of money." I said, "Give me the keys to the place. How much did you say it was?" "Oh, yes. Well, give me the keys to the place because we're moving in this afternoon." And the fellow says, "Well, a lease." And so I said, "That's your lookout." I took the keys out of his hand and we were into our original headquarters. And there were three mainline railroad trains which went one on each corner of the building in a triangle. And that's why you see to this day the Dianetic symbol in our shield. You can just imagine. Well, anyway, I remember I had been sweating it out, working away, tearing around, giving the lectures, and also ran the HGC to the degree that any time an auditor had any difficulty with a case, I brought the case into my office, and I banged him down in the conscience, got the case started, handed him back to the auditor, and roll him. I used to crack cases, pangity, 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 you see, and then run off and give another lecture and so forth, and gave a night course, and the original HAS course mock-up, which you have now, is the original Elizabeth mock-up. PE came much later. And that was simply that for a certain fee, a number of people could take a rather long, elementary, indefinite course, but they were definitely taught exact data. And they were taught exact data out of book one, Dionysius Modern Science of Mental Health. They were just taught this book. It wasn't somebody lecturing about how nice life was. They were just told this data, you see. And n-grams and locks and that sort of thing were described to them and so forth. And those people all moved over 100% onto the original HCA course. Well, it was fantastic. I'd give this about, I think it ran about 3 nights a week and so forth. It's what you'd see now as the equivalent of the HAS course. See, it wasn't an academy course. It wasn't a PE. These students were given full student responsibility, don't you think? They weren't given very much auditing, but they were given some, and so on. Now, the first real blow along this sort of thing came when I got a hold of the Elizabeth auditors, and I called them together in a staff meeting. We used to have lots of staff meetings, and it was a query on my part. What do you want to call yourselves? It's all right with me, call yourselves anything. What do you want to call yourselves? And they said, well, so-and-so, and they'd get a lot of suggestions. They didn't discuss it there. They were going to have a meeting so that they could decide on this, you see. And they had to get the Los Angeles auditors a little bit later. This was not decided for some time, by the way. And they got the Los Angeles auditors to have a staff meeting, decide what they were going to call themselves, don't you see? And they came back with Hubbard Dianetic Auditor. And I said, Hubbard Dianetic Auditor. All right. Well, okay, I could see myself walking into something here, you see. It's all right with me. You boys want to call yourself that, all right. And Los Angeles, flicker-flack back and forth on the telegraphs and so forth. And they, Hubbard Dianetic Auditor. That was passed. I didn't have anything to do with it. Oddly enough, many years later, we tried to drop this name, and it was very peculiar, but all of a sudden, we had a completely empty school, nobody wanted the other certificate, and there were no students of any kind, and eventually, when the certificate was reoffered again in Scientology, I think it was Hubbard Scientology Auditor and so forth, we instantly had a full academy. So these boys had a good instinct on this, and they knew what they were doing, but they didn't want to be known as anything else. Now, the point is that I, at that time, was trying to, well, I, after all, had a body to run, and this back in 1950, and I had a body to run, and it was a bad show, because I wasn't getting any sleep, and I wasn't getting very much to eat, and that sort of thing. And I had a very amusing story goes in connection with this, because just before the 9th of March, I had been run into a chap by the name of Palmer over at the Explorers Club who had just had to drop an expedition. It was an expedition to the Duodecanese, some islands which are just south of Greece, to dig up a ship which lies in 30 fathoms of water down there, which is full of statuary from Greece, and it's a Roman ship of Roman times, and there might be something in there by some boy like Praxiteles or something like that, don't you see? So he had run into me at the club and, oh, hi, Ron. I haven't got much time to talk to you. Do you want an expedition? I said, do I want an expedition? What's the matter with you? He said, well, you know that thing I've been talking about, going over to the Duodecanese and so forth, well, that's all off. The Ecuadorian government has got an exploration that they want me to conduct down there. And as a matter of fact, I got to go right now. And, oh, by the way, here's all the packet materials and all the appointments and the visas and everything that goes along with this and so forth, and it's all yours, Ron. Well, oddly enough, interestingly enough, it was really an even swap, because right at the middle of the beginning of World War II, the Ecuadorian government had, in connection with the Explorers Club up there, had gotten in touch with a fellow by the name of James Robert Gresham. And Jimmy Gresham couldn't think of anybody to take to Ecuador but me. The Ecuadorian government offered him 50,000 square miles of Ecuador if he could go in and find out who was in that territory. And we were going to go down there, but I unfortunately had a commission in the Navy and there was a war on. Anyway, this all sounds very involved, but here the thing came back to me again. Palmer walks into the Explorers Club. He's all excited. He's going down to Ecuador. They're still looking for somebody to go in and get his head lost. So there's the packet, he says. There's the packet. It was just before the publication of the first book. I said, this is pretty interesting. Go on down there and do some deep sea diving, only 30 fathoms. What do you know? Nice, worn, duodecanese, and so on. So I started writing around to people and connected them as the heir apparent to this expedition and started to whip it up. But there was money available and there was everything else. Those lines are still hanging there, not quite connected. But actually, if you could imagine it, I was thinking, still in the middle of 1950, of occasionally nibbling around about this expedition. You know, it sounded awful good. And the deeper we got into 1950, the better it looked. And one day the general manager, after a big board meeting and so forth, got in touch with me, and he says, Ron, he says, you've got to front up here. You've got to front up for these people. He says, they're depending on you and so forth. Well, I wasn't doing anything, not fronting up. I was just working like mad and wasn't paying much attention to the figurehead on something. I'm still telling people this sort of thing. And he said, you must do that. And I, that goes your any liberty or freedom of motion you have, don't you see, on something like this. And I shook my head. In the interim, between the time seeing was just about 2 hours apart, these times are, I found out that Joe Winter was using the fact of my attributing the development of the subject to a nebulous group of non-existent scientists to squirrel the whole cockeyed lot. And we had some kind of a wild cross going. Mind you, this was a working subject. This was not an unworking subject at all. And we had cases snapping out of it, and we had people coming in and going out shouting three cheers and that sort of thing. It was just good straight Dianetics. It wasn't very soon there. I'm starting to get difficulties with cases, starting to run into cases which were being audited in some peculiar way. I was getting somebody there who was telling people that auditing is an art. There's nothing scientific about it. You can imagine somebody telling you. You can imagine somebody telling students that. A wide open invitation to walk around and do gestalt therapy while they eat candy or something and not do anything for anybody. Well, that was the state that mental health was in at the time of the emergence of Dianetics. Nobody had anything done for him. It was everybody had some kind of weird opinion. I remember they had something running called psychodrama in those days, and it sure is. But these subjects were all pretense subjects, don't you see? You listen to them, they read awful good in the books, but I have the last textbook that was published by psychology, which was uninfluenced by Dianetics. And I took it off the line with my own little pink hand down at the American Book Bindery, because it came off the line. It was the basic textbook of psychology for the University of Chicago. And it rolled off the line, and the last copy of that binding went off the line as the first copy of Dianetics came on. So I just turned around to the girl who was in charge and I said, "Do you mind?" And picked up the copy. It was right off the binder rollers. I said, "Do you mind if I take this book?" "No, go ahead." She was, after all, making her fortune off me, so perfectly all right. And I have that book to this day. Actually, it was insufficiently dried, so its cover is warped. But so is its contents. And I picked up that book. I picked up that book for evidence. For evidence, because I knew that the book following, just behind it, was never going to afterwards have a straight picture of what psychology was. I knew that. And it's got man's IQ cannot be changed. He's an unchanging animal. We don't know anything about what the psyche is, and therefore we can't give you a proper definition for a psyche. You see, it's got all that stuff in it, don't you see? Well, I didn't want this. I didn't want Dianetics being influenced to that degree. And it occurred to me then and there that there was some truth in what the general manager of the Elizabeth Foundation was saying to me. And I was still a bit queasy about this, though. It seemed to me like, you know, saying, all right, positively and completely, owning up to the truth of it is, I wrote it all, I did it all, it's been in the works since 1938, don't you see? That was a brave statement. So he backed me up against the wall about 2 hours after the first meeting, and he says, well, he says, have you decided? He says, because this is probably going to be a very crucial point. And I said, yes, I decided. All right, you can tell him I did it all. And I talked from that viewpoint thereon, which is, of course, the truthful viewpoint. Well, I was very reluctant that I took over this type of hat and responsibility, because I knew that all hell was going to break loose, and boy, did it. There was some gal who had left me forever, for instance, down in Savannah, Georgia, the year before, and somewhere toward the beginning of that of the year just previously, hearing things were in the wind, she had turned up and I couldn't get rid of her. I'd have anything to do with her. I wasn't anything, you see. Naval officers being naval officers, they accumulate baggage. My life was not prepared to be a wide-open book. I had been a writer all my life. I had lived in Greenwich Village and so forth. As a matter of fact, my life was sufficiently incredible that I seldom wrote stories about it because they were too unbelievable. And I used to actually have to lie about my life because I was accustomed to boys of my own age or young people or writers of my own age and so forth sitting there, you know, and just calling me a bloody liar. I'd tell them the truth, you see. Well, it didn't pay. It didn't pay. So what you did is water it all down, don't you see? The truth of the matter was, pretty exclamatory sort of point existence. My adventures did not take place in my own textbooks, in my own, that is say, my own fiction stories. They took place in the raw, and this sort of thing is very easy to catch up with. If you're preparing for the seminary and so forth, why don't live the life of a pirate? Going to go before a committee of evidence, make sure you have a clean nose for a number of years, or at least since the last amnesty. Well, nobody issued me any amnesties. This girl, she was hammering and pounding around the place and so forth, and there were psychologists all over the place. The commies decided they were going to take us out of the running. And at that time, a definition of a psychotic person was one who thought the communists were after him. They had carefully planted this in the mores of the society, which is a very interesting definition. I don't know, we may do the same thing someday. It's very successful. When we want to get somebody, why, we just spread it around, you see. The definition of a psychotic is somebody who thinks the Scientologists are after him, you know. And then we promptly go after him. I'm afraid we wouldn't do anything that bald. We don't have to. But when things were really blowing up, it was quite interesting that when I approached the Justice Department concerning the state of our organizations and so forth and gave them a list of 200 and some names and asked them to please tell me which of these people were known as subversive agents, they countered. Edgar Hoover's boy there countered, and he said, no, he said, I'll give you back the names who are not communists, and therefore I myself won't be hung with the fact of having given any state information to anybody. People like to weave the idea that I'm in bad here or there, or people think badly of me, and that sort of thing. That is definitely not the case. If I were in Washington in 1955, if I'd cared to work at it, I probably could have wangle legislation protecting Scientology. It's quite the reverse picture, don't you think? These guys, I'd go in to see them. Today, I'd go in Washington to see the guys that, oh, yes, gosh, how are you? And the letters I receive on my business lines and that sort of thing. Oh, thank you. Thank you for writing us, don't you say? Very courteous, and so on. The atmosphere which has been built up in some people's minds, you see, is there's something not quite nice or there's something not quite right about being a Scientologist. And, well, that's just an operation. That's nonsense. Right at the top, I hear nothing but the snap of the right index finger touching the cap brim wherever I go. It's very interesting. The situation is very good where we are. But in those days, it was equally good. And the FBI was very nice about this, and out of 200 and some names, they turned me back 30. My press relations man, during that period of time, was not just a communist. He was actually wanted by the FBI. And they actually put their hands on him and put him away a very short time afterwards. Revenge was taken against these people that we're never told about. Actually, the FBI rounded the worst of them up. Some of them fled to Mexico, some of them did this. But these were people who were really kicking our heads in. They were robbing offices. Oh, it's very incredible. There were a couple of murders. This is a wild and lurid time I'm talking about. Well, of course, everybody says, well, you couldn't, everybody says, they must have had something very wrong and so forth. Yes, there was something very wrong. The most forward philosophy of the world is making the most progress is communism. And it met its match. And it recognized that it had met its match. Democracy as a philosophy had gone completely flat and stale. There wasn't any religious backwash. You see, against any expansion. They didn't have any opponent anywhere in the line, and they were under orders at that particular time to infiltrate all social and domestic groups, don't you see, to do this, that, and the other thing, and subvert things. They had everything running their own way. It was all fine. All of a sudden, somebody stands up, and he says, there's another philosophy in the world. And they went to work on that fast. Now, you think, all right, after this length of time, it's very hard to believe it. But I was the guy who was hearing the bullets go snap past his ear. Murder, sudden death. Reads like James Bond and Tamer Pages. I rescued a woman who had been electric shocked half to death and was so drugged she couldn't even open up her eyes. They had tried to get her to swear out a warrant to get me committed. An airplane was ticking over at an airport. This is incredible stuff. An airplane was ticking over at an airport to pick me up and fly me to St. Louis, put me in a spin bin where I would never be heard of again. Interesting. The two boys who were sent to pick me up and so forth, unfortunately, had not been as well trained in the science of combat as myself. That's right. They speak once in a while of pistol whipping. Well, there's where the pistol whipping occurred. I wasn't pistol whipped. I said, this is just too confounded thick. I don't know who my friends are. I don't know who my enemies are. I don't know anything about anything. All I know is I want to get the book I'm writing on finished. So I just withdrew from the whole scene. I know I've left you the definite impression that there were a lot of things going on that you have not been informed of, but I can assure you that there were a lot of things going on that I was never fully informed of. All I know is that I had taken over my hat rightly, and the second I stood into the run wearing my own hat, hard and heavy, that is to say, I'm me, all hell broke loose, and I was trying to hold the fort. It's taken the better part of 15 years to where a foothold could be put in to a point where that hat can be worn in this society. Because it's a hat, of course, that speaks about freedom. It speaks about the betterment of man. It speaks about this sort of thing that you don't have to be a slave. It assaults the very foundations, you see, of your economic systems. It assaults the very guts of the foundation we live in. This is another philosophy, entirely different philosophy. A philosophy that people can't be lied to. You can see through the magic spells, don't you see? The black magic spells being woven. This is a civilization where some N Theta kid sitting in a government chair telling everybody how bad it all is over there and so forth can all of a sudden get 30 million people killed, as one fellow named Hitler did. This is an interesting civilization, and that's because people don't know who they are or what they are, where they're going or what they're doing. All right, you start laying the truth on the line. And it's liable to blow off a bit of confusion. All you got to do is put in a stable datum, and the confusion starts to blow up. In the early days of Dianetics, this is the early beginnings of Scientology, of course, it was the same exact moment, didn't violate that rule a bit. And you hear a lot about things going on this way and things going on that way. What happened then? And wasn't it all terrible and so forth? No, we got through just because of one thing. As I finally, in July of that year, in spite of the turbulence and everything, listened to people's pleas along this line, and I wore my hat of being me, and nobody has ever been able to throw me off of that line since. There have been a lot of tries, and it's very, very, very turbulent. But being able to stand up and say you're yourself, and you did it, and yes, I'm the fellow who wrote the book, yes, I'm the fellow who dreamed it up, yes, I'm the fellow who leads this group, and don't qualify any way, shape, or form. Don't go backing up and saying, well, as a matter of fact, I am God's anointed child on earth. God, you see, God appeared to me in a dream, and all of his lightning bolts, you see, are going to hit if you don't accept this fact. This is it's perfectly all right to be somebody's deputy if he exists. But how about dreaming one up? How about dreaming up a source to be a deputy of? Perfectly all right to be a deputy. I myself found out, greatly to my relief, many, many years before Dianetics and so on, that I was a very good subordinate. I found out I'm excellent. I took a great deal of pride in this, because most of my life, up to that time, I had been solely and entirely in command. And I began to wonder if there was something wrong with me, if I was the kind of fellow who only had to be in command. Was I the kind of fellow that couldn't be any place else but in charge, you see? Because I had these chaps around, you know, fellows who couldn't be anything else. And one day I was appointed to a very subordinate post, and I had several officers in echelon immediately above me. I wasn't even really in charge of a section, don't you see? I was just a subordinate with a capital S. You know, after quite a while on that post and so forth, I suddenly looked at it and wondered why I was so pleased with myself. I was just grinning at myself. I look at myself in the mirror and find myself grinning, you know. And it was just because I was perfectly well qualified to be a subordinate, and everybody was happy with me as a subordinate, and they knew the things going on. I mean, the commanding officer in that particular instance would wave his hand in my direction and say, Hubbard, so-and-so, and so-and-so, you know, and Hubbard would go, do so-and-so, and stick some up. Just like he said, you know, no embellishments. Took all the privileges of subordinate, you know, privileges of a subordinate is to goof, you know, to goof on occasion. You don't have anything to do, why don't do anything, you know. I remember the CO of this particular instance used to leave at 10 o'clock in the morning. We were lying in dock, and there was no particular reason under the sun, moon, and stars to be around the ship, and I think I had about 60 ensigns. And he used to come in the morning. I'd be there about 8 o'clock and straighten everything out, and he used to come in about 9 o'clock, something like that, and then he'd hit the beach. Nautical term. He'd hit the beach, you see, with his cap and his raincoat on and so forth, and go home and read his pipe or something. And so when he walked in, he'd give me a whole string of orders, rat-a-tat-tat-a-tat-tat-a-tat-tat. As a matter of fact, he was dead wrong. It was the lousiest sort of subordinateizing, see, whereby the top man is skipping his second-in-command because you are effective and efficient, and the second-in-command is not effective and efficient, and this is being made plain to the second-in-command by the top man, you know? I mean, one of these unbearable situations, you know? So the old man walked in, he gave me a whole string of orders, and I'd go around and give all the ensigns their hot water bottles to rush from here to there or whatever it was. Turn out the men, run them into divisions, have the inspection, that sort of thing. The old man hit the beach, I think, about 10 o'clock. And 10:15, I'd look around, see everybody was working, so forth. Put two or three of my chiefs alert on the situation, pat everybody on the back, get on my white cap, white top cap, my raincoat, pick up my briefcase, hit the beach. One day, everything was running like apple pie order, you see. The men knew if they got me in trouble, why, they'd be in trouble, so nobody got me in trouble and so forth. And probably there were dozens of them beneath me and these hundreds and hundreds of men and so forth that also probably hit the beach at 10:30, don't you? And one day at 10:15, I was clattering down the steps, ready to go ashore. It was in a big administration building. What we were doing was putting a ship in commission. And all of a sudden, why, that man's name, by the way, was Roger Edison Perry, Captain USN, old line. And Perry, you know, that is the Perry. And he was a descendant along these lines. And he was really all Navy, but actually a principal guy. And my God, he's forgotten something. And there I am, almost to the bottom of the steps, dressed for shore. And there he is, coming back to get his briefcase or something of the sort. So he says, well, Hubbard, he said, are you going over to the ship? I said, no, sir. He said, are you hitting, you've got a conference over with the building instructors or something? I said, no, sir. He said, well, what are you doing? He says, dressed up and so forth. And I said, I'm going ashore, Captain. And he said, well, this is just a rare occasion. Christ, he didn't want to offend me. I was running his whole ship on. He said, this is just a rare occasion. He said, you have some errand of your own. I said, no, sir, Captain, I do this every day. And he squirmed. And he said, well, he said, well, all right, he said, but you shouldn't make it so obvious. Very funny. Anyway, Anyway, the business of becoming a subordinate or being able to occupy a subordinate role was something that I was very happy to be able to do. But to occupy a top dog role, which is all the way up, you know, there's no government or God or something of the sort or any mystic vision back of you, and not even galactic empire status, don't you see? Couldn't even reassume one of your old identities on the whole track and saying, well, we once owned this, you know, we once owned this empire, and so forth, and just to be able to stand up in the howling winds of space, you know, that sort of thing, and confront everything simultaneously and stand there regardless of the dead cats, the alarm clocks, the bricks, and everything else which are coming your way, that took some doing. And that's all you look at when you look at this early history and so forth. It is simply a stable datum going into a very, very aberrated world. The truth of the matter is, although events of the world are moving ahead at a very giddy pace, and although there appear to be a lot of risky things going on in the world is really a better place because we are in it. Things have changed. We've changed the whole face of psychology, for instance. We've changed there are people around who know that we exist. Now, at no time, of course, could anybody have done this all by himself. It would take a... once in a while, early stabs and that sort of thing took a real beating. I'm well aware of one incident where they held off the 18 or 20 Philadelphia policemen and so forth who had come to arrest me as a witness in a bankruptcy. Nobody could ever get anything on me. I never did anything. But they can arrest and put in jail the witness in a bankruptcy suit, which is federal, don't you see? And the staff at that time in Philadelphia and so forth, when they first saw these cops starting to load up and load into the place and a couple of federal marshals and that sort of thing, simply held them off barehanded, insisted that they should show their cards and should do this and should do that. And these guys started to get cross with them. Next thing you know, it was a battle royal, man. And gave me an opportunity to catch my breath, and I finally, I don't know what would have happened. By the time the federal marshals came up to where I was, they were shaking so badly, and they were so upset and demoralized, you know, they'd had an awful time getting through that outer perimeter, that I took the gun out of one of them's hand and put it in his holster because I said, you're nervous. They were completely demoralized. They took me downtown, and I had to stand around for a while and get fingerprinted and so forth, and they didn't dare do anything because I hadn't done anything. And then they found out there'd been a dreadful mistake. You never saw federal judges and marshals and that sort of thing quite as embarrassed because they'd been told an awful lot of lies from the Wichita Foundation, which, of course, was a squirrel outfit which it continued on. Bad old days, the bad old days. I was out of there no time at all. I mean, I had... people this way and this way. In other words, people were standing up for me here, there, and every place, don't you see? And anybody trying to do anything to me was wading in through depth. But from where I looked, it looked awful lonesome occasionally. It takes some doing. It takes some doing. And we operated very well and have ever since in a sort of a ragged sort of way as a fairly compact group. And it's only been that has been possible to go ahead and make the progress we've made in society. Now, you may not think we're making too much progress in the society and so forth. We'll get back to what I was going to tell you in the first place, is we've never started. All we've been doing is standing still, waiting for the flat irons and dead cats to sort of clear out of the air. Because just putting in a stable datum of Dianetics, just putting in a stable datum of this particular character, blew off enough confusion in the society so that it would make it possible after a while for us to move. For a long time, it was impossible to hold a position very fixedly or straight. Very, very impossible. And therefore, where you see the early foundations moving this is just standard phenomena. They moved from here to there to the other place, don't you see? They used to have an axiom that it took about 2 years for the flat irons to catch up with us, you see. And after about 2 years, where there wasn't anything more you could do in that locale, and sure enough, that was about the time lag. It was tough, but we were, in actual fact, as an organization, I was standing there as a being, but as an organization, and so forth, we couldn't stand up to everything that came our way, don't you see? Now, I may have given you the impression that we made no progress and so forth. My whole idea throughout this entire time was to go on and do my researches, finish it up, and deliver the goods, in spite of every interruption and so forth, to eventually come out the other end with a case progress for every case that came under anybody's nose, that it could be done easily and so forth. And I devoted my time exclusively to research. And I paid no attention at all to the brickbats and the dead cats. Let them fly, see. Well, maybe that was rough on people. But actually, the group has constantly, more or less, been asking me to stand up, like the general manager did so that he could save his board, don't you see? Back in 1950, the group has been asking me to stand up and actually direct an advance line into the society. And instead of that, I have been sitting back, fixing up the general situation of technology and so forth so that it could be delivered. I've somehow or other kept the organizations running and functioning in spite of all these other things, but I've not concentrated on that at all. I've taken lots of time and lots of energy in pushing around communication lines and writing things for organizations, working for and working in organizations, but the bulk of my time was spent on research.